Welcome to the Fundamental Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Paul Saladino. This podcast is the result of my relentless search to understand and correct the roots of chronic disease and illness. In this podcast, I will share with you everything I have learned about how to live the most healthy and radical life possible. Thanks for joining me on this journey.
What is going on, you guys? Welcome to another episode of the Fundamental Health Podcast. I just got back from Montana. I had an amazing time up there climbing mountains with the crew from Heart and Soil, and it was so good to be at high elevation. I did a podcast with Steve Ranella that will be out soon. Amazing times in the mountains with my tribe at Heart and Soil. And as you guys all know, this is my passion project. These are desiccated organ supplements that we are sourcing from grass-fed, grass-finished, regeneratively raised cattle in New Zealand. We are developing a U.S.-based supply chain, and the goal here is really to help a few million more people reclaim their ancestral birthright to radical health with nose-to-tail nutrition. You all know that I am a huge fan of eating nose-to-tail, but for a lot of people, it's really hard to get the organs in their diet, and that is why we do what we do to make it easy to allow your family, your brothers, your sisters, your kids, your grandparents, your parents, to get conveniently encapsulated, desiccated, freeze-dried organs in their diet and get this really unique nutrition in a way that is so much easier. If you can get fresh organs, that's fantastic. But I wanted to do this in a way that would allow people to have access to these really fantastically powerful foods from really clean, well-sourced animals here in the U.S. very soon, and in New Zealand, in a way that was more convenient and more travelable. Travelable, is that a word? We took them to the top of Sacagawea Peak in the Bridger Range in Montana. You can see my Instagram or our Instagram at Heart and Soil Supplements to see photos of us crushing that almost 10,000-foot mountain from sea level living in Texas and loving it and refueling with Heart and Soil Supplements, desiccated bone marrow and liver and beef organs on top. They travel way better than fresh heart, liver, kidney, spleen, pancreas, etc. So you get the gist. Check us out, heartandsoilsupplements.com. As a listener of this podcast, I am grateful to you. I appreciate that you are in my tribe, and you can use the code CARNIVOREMD for 10% off your first order. I love you all. You are all super radical. You can also send me an email anytime you want, Dr. Paul, drpaul at heartandsoilsupplements.com if you have any questions or I can help you in any way. I spend a few hours a day now answering those emails, and I really enjoy hearing from you all. Today's podcast is a really great one. This is really the third week of our gut and microbiome series. I get so many questions about the gut and microbiome and how a zero fiber diet like the one I eat affects the gut and microbiome. And do we need fiber to have a healthy gut? Do we need fiber to poop? The first episode was with Dr. Vincent Pedre. The second episode was with Michael Ruscio. Those were the previous 2 weeks. This episode is with Lucy Mailing, PhD. You can find her at lucymailing.com. She is a PhD. She recently finished her PhD and now spends the majority of her time researching, blogging, and sharing some pretty fantastic information. I really enjoyed this conversation with her. She has her own story, much like mine, of improvement in eczema and autoimmune illness with changes in diet. She found, similarly to what I experienced, that cutting out a lot of the plant foods in her diet removed a lot of the severity of her eczema or improved her eczema. She didn't go full carnivore, but Lucy and I eat a pretty similar diet. I would say that she eats a carnivore-ish diet. We'll see. We could ask her that question in the future. I'll probably have her on again in the near future as well. So I think you will enjoy this one. We get into all sorts of stuff about individual species and phyla and fiber, what it takes to have a healthy microbiome, how we improve it once it's broken, what makes it broken in the first place. And we ask a lot of questions and leave the door open for many interesting future conversations. You should check out Lucy's blog and specifically a recent blog post about how the ketogenic diet affects the gut microbiome. In her most recent blog post, she references a paper, the name of which is Ketogenic Diets Alter the Gut Microbiome, Resulting in Decreased Intestinal Th17 Cells. What's so cool about this paper is it shows that a ketogenic diet probably affects the gut in a positive way, decreasing these Th17 cells that are associated with autoimmunity and inflammation in the gut. And as you'll see in that blog post that Lucy's written, a ketogenic diet, low in fiber, doesn't lead to decreasing mucus levels in the gut. The mucus layer does not go away, as some have claimed incorrectly based on flawed animal studies. I've discussed that in the past. Furthermore, there's a really interesting study about the seasonal variation of the Hadza microbiome. I spoke about this in my newsletter this week. If you don't get my newsletter, you can go to CarnivoreMD to get it. You can also sign up for the newsletter through heartandsoilsupplements.com. But what we find in the Hadza is that their gut microbiome shifts based on seasons. And as Lucy and I ask in this podcast, if you see undetectable levels of a certain species, can they come back the next year if your diet changes? And it appears so based on the Hadza research. So I have no concerns for myself or anyone that I work with that a zero plant fiber diet is going to be harmful for them. I've done lots of experimentation on my own gut, and it is very healthy. And as you all know, I have shared those results in the past. I have a very diverse microbiome. I do not think we need plant fiber to thrive as humans in any way, shape, or form. We can use animal fiber. So you'll enjoy this podcast with Lucy Mailing. She's amazing. Listen after the podcast for what is going on with me. And if you like this podcast, please leave me a review on iTunes. It is how we spread the good word about this podcast. Please leave me a review there. On to the sponsors. I am so grateful to my sponsors who make this possible. The first is Let's Get Checked. I spoke about them last week. Did you know that across the globe, men's healthy sperm counts have dropped 50% in the last 40 years? This is really scary. Hormonal imbalances and reduced testosterone levels are becoming commonplace in modern male health. And that for 1 in 4 men over 30, a low testosterone is prevalent and they have a hormonal imbalance with all sorts of symptoms like low energy, fatigue, erectile dysfunction, low sex drive, anxiety, brain fog, decision-making problems. It's really bad. It's scary. It's misdiagnosed. That's 1 in 4 over 30. So this is why I like to test my own blood work. You guys know I've got a blood work podcast coming out soon. And Let's Get Checked makes this super easy. I'm excited to partner with them to make professional health testing easily accessible. They have fast, affordable, and confidential at-home male hormone test kits to help you measure your testosterone there from your home. You don't even have to go to a lab. So you can go to Let's Get Checked and you'll get 20% off by using my code. So you want to go to www.trylgc.com/carnivoremd. All right. And you will get 20% off. Here's how it works. You go to www.trylgc.com/carnivoremd. You choose your test. They will be delivered to you in discreet packaging. You collect your sample at home. And then once your sample arrives in the laboratory, you will get results, which will be available to you at a secure online account within 2 to 5 days. And you can get results on 5 hormone levels, testosterone, sex hormone binding globulin, prolactin, estrogen, and your free androgen index. They will then give you a consultation reviewed by a physician, and a nurse will contact you to discuss your results. It's pretty cool. I did it for myself, and my testosterone is between 700 and 800. It is robust. You guys know this. It's because I eat nose to tail. I take care of myself, and I feel really good doing what I do, and I'm so excited to share it all with you, and I love the way Let's Get Checked allows you to do this from the comfort of your own home. I also checked my CRP. You can check your homocysteine. There are so many more tests for both men and women. All the labs are CLIA approved, the highest ranking level of accreditation. All data is anonymized to ensure your privacy. It lets you know what is going on in the inside so you can take a scientific approach to improving your life. It's not just for men who are in a funk. I think it's just good to know what your testosterone and other blood work is. That's why I test my own. So you can get 20% off at trylgc.com/carnivoremd with the code CarnivoreMD. That is trylgc.com/CarnivoreMD, CARNIVOREMD. You guys know my name, CarnivoreMD. So go do it, get tested. It's the responsible thing to do, and it's just a valuable thing. All right? Okay, you guys, I appreciate them greatly. I also appreciate, you guys know, my love of White Oak Pastures. They are whiteoakpastures.com. They are in Bluffton, Georgia, a 6th generation family farm, 120 years. In the farm, the last 20 plus doing regenerative farming. They're one of my favorite farms in the world. They do grass-fed, grass-finished meat raised in a way that sequesters carbon into the soil. This is how the planet will survive, you guys. They also have a loyalty program you should check out. There's a lot of fear right now that our food system might collapse or become sketchy, and they are doing this program to allow people to join what appears to be a club. They made me a mayor in the club. I'm so grateful. I'm a mayor of Bluffton, Georgia. You may have seen my awesome cutting board that I got for that. And so if the food system becomes shaky and you are part of their club, you are a supporter of what I believe to be one of the best farms on the planet, you will have first access to their foods. You will have good quality meat available to you no matter what. It's a fantastic idea. I love them for it. You can always use the code CarnivoreMD there for 10% off your first order. I guarantee this will be some of the best meat and organs you have ever had. Let them know I sent you. I love them dearly. I get stew meat. I get organs all the time. And I love White Oak Pastures so much. They are doing the good work. Jenny and Will Harris are amazing. Sarah's amazing. The people there are just fantastic. Hopefully we will do White Oak Chela soon. Next year, I can't wait to see you guys all there. WhiteOakPastures.com, CarnivoreMD for 10% off. I also love Blue Blocks, BLUBLOX.com. They make what I think are the best blue blocking glasses out there. Your circadian rhythm is critical, and these guys have done the research. They have made what I think are the best blue blocking glasses in terms of quality and science. They've made it so the lenses block blue and green light at night. I love wearing these. I wore them on the plane last night when I was coming home and it got delayed and I was in airports. And it really helps moderate the circadian rhythm in a way. We're not supposed to be exposed to blue light at night. I like the Jasper. You've seen me wearing them before. They're this really cool semi-hipster round glasses. It makes me look very studious. Sometimes I just wear them because they make me look studious. They make me look like it's my Clark Kent glasses, I call them. I've also got the clear lens and the orange lens. They're really great glasses. Check them out. Blue Blocks, BLUBLOX.com. You can use the code CarnivoreMD for 15% off your purchase. And I am so excited to be able to share that with you. They also make an amazing, amazing sleep mask. So they are good folks. I also want to give a shout out to my people at Nutrisense.io. You guys know this is this continuous glucose monitor that I appreciate so much. I've got one sitting on my desk. I'm going to put another one on, do some more experiments. Listen to the CGM episode if you want to know more about this. CGM will change the way you behave. Real-time feedback is incredibly powerful. I can't wait for my dad to use this. And I love the folks at forceofnaturemeats.com. They are doing more great work in terms of regenerative agriculture here in Texas and abroad. Forceofnaturemeats.com. They have ground organs, ground elk, ground bison, ground lamb, ground beef, and they do an organ grind. They're pretty cool. Check out Force of Nature. Without further ado, onto the podcast, you guys. I love you all. Listen after for what is going on with me. All right, Lucy Mailing, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, you're a very well-respected, requested guest on this. I've been following a lot of your stuff on, what is it, Next Gen Med? What's your website?
Next Gen Medicine.
Next Gen Medicine. Got some amazing blogs there on all sorts of gut stuff, so we'll dig into it. It'll be fun. So I listened to a talk of yours at AHS, and it was about butyrate and the colon and SIBO and leaky gut and fiber, and I thought, oh, this is so cool. I want to talk about it. Before we dive into all that, why don't you tell people a little bit about your background and all the cool stuff you're doing and how the heck you got interested in all this GI stuff?
Yeah. So interestingly, I didn't know till today, but we actually share a lot in our background with eczema.
Oh.
So it was that led me to ancestral health, nutrition, gut health, all of that. So I pretty much ate a junk food diet my entire childhood, and wasn't really until I came across the connections between the gut and skin health that things started to improve. So that's really how I got interested, and then decided to pursue my PhD studying the microbiome, and just finished that last August.
Congrats. That's huge.
Thanks. And actually was planning to go to med school next, but it's looking like I'm going to do a postdoc instead,
okay,
which I'm really excited about.
And what did you study in your PhD? You did a lot with exercise in the microbiome, right?
Right.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, so my lab at the University of Illinois, I worked under Dr. Jeff Woods, and we studied essentially the effects of diet and exercise on the gut microbiome in states of health and disease. We were the first to look at the effects of exercise training longitudinally in humans. This is really bright. I think
you want to switch over there.
Need to shift a little.
Technical.
I can't see you.
Technical.
All right. That's much better.
We're doing an outdoor podcast for those of you guys that can't hear this.
Yeah.
There's a video on YouTube if you're missing it.
Yeah.
Is that better?
Much better.
Okay.
Yeah, so a lot of my graduate research was focused on the beneficial effects of exercise and how that can modulate the microbiome. We did work in both animal models and in humans. So in animal models, we showed that exercise can boost microbial diversity. It actually increases butyrate producers. So it's not just fiber. Things like exercise can also affect the amount of butyrate producers in the gut. Has a lot of other beneficial effects on gut health as well. And some of which I'll be talking about tomorrow, actually, in my talk here at the Physicians for Ancestral Health retreat. We've also done studies in humans that have shown benefits. So definitely a lot there in terms of the benefits that exercise can have. Now, it definitely depends on the modality and how strenuous the exercise is. So in animal models, we've actually shown that forced treadmill running is detrimental to gut health, whereas voluntary real running in mice improves their gut health and prevents colitis. So some really interesting work that we've done there.
So if you overdo it, if you do like too much working out, that can be negative for the gut.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So let's back up and just set the stage for people with that little teaser. What the heck is the gut microbiome? Why do we care? Tell us about this, because I haven't done a whole lot of episodes about the microbiome, and
okay,
you're a good person to speak to this.
Yeah. So the gut microbiome has really been implicated or associated with virtually every chronic disease that we know. Influences pretty much every other organ in the body, and really has just widespread impacts on our health. And there's a lot we still don't know, but it's a really exciting area of study, and we're learning more every day. We've got better sequencing technology every day to really understand these microbial communities and what they can do for our health. So that was kind of my reason for getting really interested in the microbiome was the fact that it has such an impact on our health.
So it's trillions of bacteria, right? And viruses,
right,
and fungi.
Mm-hmm.
We have like a whole other organism living in our gut. What are the most recent estimates that you've heard regarding the number of bacteria in our gut? Because this always changes, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think the most recent estimate that I'm aware of was from, I believe, 2014. And they estimated 3.8 trillion bacterial cells, which is about 1.3 times the amount of human cells. So it was previously thought that it was 10 to 1 bacteria to human. Now it's 1.3 to 1. But it really doesn't matter. It's kind of just this massive, previously unrecognized organ inside,
yes,
our gut that has such a massive effect on our health. So, yeah.
So trillion is 10 to the 15th, right? 3.8 times 10 to the 15th?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of zeros after this. And that's just bacteria. And of those bacteria, there's gram-positive, gram-negative, and aerobic and anaerobic, right? So the gram-positive and the gram-negative have to do with the cell wall, whether it takes up this cellular stain that colors them either purple or pink. And then the aerobic or anaerobic has to do with whether the bacteria can thrive under conditions of oxygen, right? There's a little more nuance there, but how would you divide those bacteria up into classes?
Right. I think actually the obligate anaerobes versus facultative anaerobes is really a good distinction,
mm-hmm,
and is one of the things we can look at when we're looking at how healthy the gut is, because it's supposed to be a healthy colon is supposed to be an anaerobic environment,
mm-hmm,
and have a predominance of obligate anaerobes. And that means bacteria that can only survive in an environment that has very, very low oxygen. And when we see an expansion of what are called facultative anaerobes, these are common pathogens, E. coli, Salmonella, a lot of the bacteria in the proteobacteria phylum,
mm-hmm,
tend to expand in gut dysbiosis and are associated with chronic inflammatory diseases. So that, I think, is the most helpful distinction in thinking about gut communities and how we can kind of break it down. And, you know, there's everyone's gut microbiome is individual. So there's many different states of dysbiosis, just as there's many different states of health. But that being said, I think one of the key characteristics of a dysbiotic community that's been demonstrated across multiple different diseases is an abundance of proteobacteria, those facultative anaerobes that tend to really like oxygen. And actually that oxygen comes from poor gut metabolism and oxygen leaking into the lumen of the gut and feeding those facultative anaerobes.
Those organisms. Okay. Yeah, lots to unpack there for people. So we're talking, basically right now, we're mostly talking about colonic microflora, right?
Correct.
And so there's been a lot recently said about small intestinal microbiome versus mm-hmm. colonic microbiome. So we're thinking about different parts of the gut, right? The colon is the large bowel. It starts at the ileocecal valve, has that cecum on the right side. People may know that's where the appendix hangs out. It goes up, and then it goes across the transverse colon, then it goes down the sigmoid colon. That's the colon. And what we're generally talking about in terms of the microbiome colloquially is the populations of bacteria there. Because there's not supposed to be quite as many bacteria as we move up from the colon, is there?
Right.
Or are there, you know, right?
Well, there still is definitely a small intestinal microbiome,
right.
And it's very important to health. And small intestinal dysbiosis is very common in people who have functional GI disorders, you know, IBS type symptoms. So it's definitely, even though there's fewer number of bacteria, the quality of the microbiome there is still very important to determining our health and maintaining a lack of GI symptoms.
Right. And I guess that's super important just to highlight for people, as you're saying, that dysbiosis, you mentioned that word. How would you define dysbiosis? This word gets thrown around a
yeah.
lot. I just want to make sure the listener understands. It's kind of a waste basket term, but how do you define dysbiosis?
Yeah, it's a very loosely used term.
Right.
And I think generally it refers to an altered state of the microbiome that is associated with disease. And so, you know, the truth is we know a lot about the microbiome, but there's so much that we don't know. And so I've often said a healthy microbiome is the microbiome you have when you're healthy, and a dysbiotic microbiome is probably the microbiome that you have when you're in a disease state. So I think that's really the best we can define it, even though there are some characteristics, low diversity, high proteobacteria, that tend to be common in these states of dysbiosis.
Right. And so just what we were talking about earlier is that if you were to trace the number, just the sheer numbers of bacteria as you move out of the stomach and into the small bowel, the duodenum, the jejunum, mm-hmm. and the ileum, which are the technical three sections of the small bowel as it moves from the stomach to the colon, there would be a gradually increasing number of bacteria. Is that accurate to say?
Yeah, pretty much.
And that the small bowel in general has less populations of bacteria. We talked about those populations still have a diversity
mm-hmm.
and can become disordered, but they generally have less. And then we move to the colon, there generally are more bacteria, and there's a kind of a separate set of populations there.
Right.
And I love that you defined proteobacteria. So this one gets thrown around a lot, and I want people to understand this. When we say phylum,
mm-hmm.
this just goes back to like high school or like my college biology class, you know, like King Phil, you know, Kingdom, Phylum, Class, Order, Genus, Species. Do you remember that acronym? Do you remember
right.
my name? King Phil came over for dinner or something like that. Do you remember?
I don't remember exactly what it is, but
it's like at the biggest level, we have kingdoms of life,
mm-hmm.
the plant kingdom, the animal kingdom, right?
Right.
And so this is the bacterial kingdom.
Right.
And within the bacterial kingdom, we divide those into multiple phyla.
Mm-hmm.
So what are some of the big phyla of bacteria?
Yeah, so the five that are most prevalent in the human gut would be Bacteroidetes and Firmicutes. Those make up 90% of a typical healthy gut. Then we have Actinobacteria, Verrucomicrobia, which is a phylum that only contains the microbe Akkermansia mucinophilia, which is kind of a special one. And then Proteobacteria is the fifth.
So on a GI map, for people that are listening, if they've had a GI map panel, you'll see on that panel a ratio of Bacteroidetes
mm-hmm.
and Firmicutes. I was pronouncing it forever wrong. I said Firmicutes.
That one kind of goes both ways.
All these pronunciations.
Yeah.
Tomato, tomato. And so there's other ones. But generally, they don't show those on a GI map. Those are the two. And Bacteroidetes to
mm-hmm.
Firmicutes has been talked about with obesity, that ratio.
Right.
Who knows if that really holds.
Yeah.
But we're talking about at the phyla levels, these five big families of bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a special bacteria that's only one in that family, the Akkermansia.
Mm-hmm.
We can talk about that one later.
Yeah.
But the proteobacteria, I think this is a helpful designation because generally it seems like in the space people are accepting now that if you have high populations of proteobacteria, that's a bad family. Those are the bad guys, right? And those are generally, you said, they're gram-negative anaerobes.
Facultative anaerobes,
right.
meaning that they they tend to outcompete obligate anaerobes when there's oxygen present.
Right. So they're not and then they're not aerobes, though. They're not gram negative, they're not anaerobic organisms. Or they're not aerobic organisms.
Correct.
Right, right.
Correct. So they can basically either do anaerobic or aerobic
metabolism,
even though they tend towards anaerobic. But if they're in the gut environment competing with other organisms and oxygen becomes present, they tend to favor that aerobic metabolism to outcompete their neighbors.
Right. And you mentioned a couple of these are things like, what are some examples?
Salmonella, E. coli, Citrobacter, Clostridium difficile, a lot of these, Clostridium difficile is incorrect. That's not proteobacteria. But a lot of these pathogens,
right.
Staphylococcus, Streptococcus, that are normally present in a healthy gut, but at a very, very low abundance. So typically proteobacteria in a healthy gut is about 3% or lower of bacterial abundance, total bacterial abundance. Whereas in an inflammatory chronic disease state, you often see it expand much greater than that.
And so what kind of tests do you use to look at the populations? Like if somebody were going to look, because GI Map isn't going to show people that. Do you still use Ubiome or did they stop doing that test?
Yeah, Ubiome unfortunately went bankrupt.
Right. I was talking to Tommy about this the other day.
So that's not an option anymore. I'm not a huge fan of GI Map anymore. I was using them, but have reason to question their accuracy and reproducibility.
Okay.
So recently I've moved towards using Onegevity, which is using metagenomics. So that's where they take every single gene in the sample and they're sequencing the entire basically the entire microbial genome and mapping it to a database. So it's got greater specificity down to the species and strain level, greater accuracy as well, because they're looking at the entirety of the genome. And they do also allow you to look at bacterial abundance, archaea, fungi, basically everything that's in the sample. So
in a Onegevity sample, you could look at the percentage for proteobacter and get a sense of that, and that would be valuable.
Correct.
Does Onegevity do other pathogens? That was one of the things I liked about GI Map, is it would do worms and it would do, you know, like blastocystis and all those other things. Does Onegevity do those?
So they do report some pathogens, but not some of the ones that are like questionably pathogenic, like blastocystis, which is unfortunate. You can find it in the raw data. So if you download the raw data, you can search and find those pathogens. Supposedly, they're going to be, I've heard through the grapevine that they might be making the report more clinically minded this year. Mm-hmm. So I'm hopeful that those changes will improve what we can gain from looking at that.
So you might combine Onegevity with either GIFX or GI Map?
Yeah, potentially. Or even, I don't love culture-based.
Right. GIMAP is mostly culture-based, right?
GIMAP is qPCR.
Now it went to qPCR. Oh, no, the GIMAP is qPCR, but the
GIFX, doctor's data are culture-based.
We're getting really in the weeds here, you guys. Sorry. I'm just like geeking out about stool tests. My listeners are like, what the heck are these guys talking about? Okay, yes. So GIFX, culture-based, not a fan of that.
Correct, but still valid for the parasitology. Mm-hmm. So you could combine the parasitology of doctor's data with Onegevity, potentially.
Right.
But the testing space definitely... I'm hoping that we're going to see some improvements in the near future.
It's really wide open for somebody to come in and just do a good gut test. Because like you said, a lot of chronic disease is connected with things in the gut. Mm-hmm. And as clinicians, we need to be able to look at people's guts, or at least the colonic microbiome. And we can talk about whether these tests are surveying, you know, colonic versus small intestinal microbiome. We need something that works. Like we said, GI Map, quantitative PCR, it's polymerase chain reaction. GIFX is a Genova test. It's culture-based, going to miss a lot of things. Mm-hmm. Parasitology in that one, is it microscopic parasitology on a GI? Or do they do PCR for parasitology on a GIFX?
GIFX, I'm not sure. I'm guessing they're using microscopy or the immunoassays or a combination. I think that's doctor's data does the same as well, microscopy plus immunoassays.
So probably Onegevity plus GI Map is the best we've got right
now. Yeah, I mean, that's unfortunate that that's the case, because it does end up being very expensive when you're, you know, combining all of those to get the different aspects.
Right,
but,
right.
So.
Okay. And so we talked about alpha diversity. We talked about diversity. Let's just talk about alpha diversity versus, you know, maybe beta diversity. This term gets thrown around a lot.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really interesting thing. And we were kind of chatting about it before the podcast, and we can kind of segue this into fiber and the microbiome and stuff if we want. But diversity. I guess people will probably get a sense of this already before we go into it. So we talked about proteobacteria. You don't want that phyla. Those are the bad actors, right? Those are the guys who are from the wrong side of the tracks. You know, I'm sure they're good at heart, but they're not good actors in our gut. And then the other piece of that you mentioned is not a, a low alpha diversity, meaning there's not a whole lot of different species in the gut. How would you describe that to somebody, the alpha diversity or the importance of a diverse microbiome?
Yeah, so alpha diversity is really looking at the diversity within a sample versus beta diversity is usually looking between samples. So that's usually in a study that you'd be looking at beta diversity versus alpha diversity. We're looking in a single individual. What's the diversity of organisms in their gut? So that's looking at both the number of unique organisms in their gut and also kind of the spread across in terms of, you know, if you had a number, a lot of unique organisms, but 90% of them were one microbe, that wouldn't be a very diverse gut. So it's also looking at the evenness across species as well.
The distribution.
The distribution, right.
Okay. And so we generally want, or in studies, it looks like a higher alpha diversity is generally better.
Typically.
As we know,
right.
You can have a high alpha diversity with a bunch of proteobacteria,
yes.
A bunch of bad actors. But if you have low proteobacteria, or you have low bad actors, generally a higher alpha diversity is better, right?
Generally, yeah.
Okay. And what do we see like in indigenous people? Like, why do we think, how do we know, or why do we think alpha diversity is a good measure? Like, what kind of things are we looking at there?
Yeah. So pretty much any study of ancestral populations, existing hunter-gatherers suggests that we have minuscule microbial diversity in comparison to them. So we've already, estimates suggest that we've already lost about half of our ancestral diversity in the microbiome. And basically they've shown that with increasing westernization, you tend to have decreasing diversity in the gut microbiome. So we've definitely, you know, depleted the organisms that we evolved with in many ways. Although maybe we've also seen some shift toward, you know, compensating for our modern environment as well.
And I think that the question then becomes, why did we lose them, right? You said something there, like this increasing westernization. And I would love to get your thoughts, and then maybe I can offer some of mine. Like, what do you think is going on? Why have we lost those organisms?
Yeah, so there's a number of really interesting hypotheses, and some seem very obvious to us, right? Like antibiotics is a very, very simple answer to that question. Obviously, antibiotics have led to progressive loss of microbial diversity. We've also, recent studies have also suggested that 24% of non-antibiotic medications also impact the gut and are potentially leading to loss of important species.
Like what kind of medications?
There's honestly pretty much all across the spectrum. There was this study that looked at thousands of different drug compounds, and almost everyone in different categories could have some impact on the microbiome. Now, how many of those are impacting it in a way that's really detrimental? We don't know. But
so blood pressure medications.
Sure, blood pressure medications, statins.
Statins, NSAIDs.
NSAIDs, definitely. Proton pump inhibitors.
Got to be a bad one.
Yeah.
We can talk about PPIs. That can't be a good thing. Completely abolish your normal pH in your gut, that's not a good thing.
But even like antidepressants, you know, anything that's going in orally is,
right.
You know, is going to have some interaction with the gut microbiome.
Wow. So, okay.
And then there's also, in terms of thinking about things that might deplete our diversity, it's really interesting to look at seasonality in hunter-gatherer populations. They've shown that there was a study published in Science on the Hadza that actually showed that the seasonality of their diet was what led to was likely what led to increased diversity, because they were eating different things during different periods of the year, and essentially certain microbes would go down to almost non-existent in the gut, only to flourish again in the next season when they were eating different foods that led to those. And those same microbes that oscillated the most in that study between the wet and the dry season for these hunter-gatherers were the same microbes that are lost in today's modern Western populations.
Interesting. You know, I'd spoken to someone or seen something somewhere about, I think it was one of my guests that had been with the Hadza on a hunt. Oh. And he was describing the way that they were just like putting their hands in the animal and into the animal's bowels and the animal's stomach. And we know that, aren't there good studies that show that with animals, even dogs, that alpha diversity can increase, right?
Yeah.
So I've got to believe that being an ancestral human, touching animals that you're hunting, touching animals that you live with, whether it's cows or dogs or, you know, touching animals that you've killed, that's got to affect your microbiome too, don't you think?
Yeah, definitely. And that's actually the hygiene hypothesis was essentially built around that idea that people who grew up around animals were less likely to get allergies, autoimmune disease, likely due to increased microbial diversity and microbial exposure.
Everybody go pet your dog. Find somebody else's dog to pet in the park. Go pet your dog. Don't wash your hands and eat dinner with your hands. That's the way to get a good microbial diversity. You know, I recently went hunting and it reminded me, things have been super stressful for me. I've been kind of cloistered in my apartment in San Diego. I've been surfing. That probably changes the microbial diversity in my gut. But I'm out in the woods and I'm dirty. You know, I got dirt under my fingernails. Mm-hmm. I don't always have the ability to wash my hands. If I'm going to wash my hands, I'm going to wash them in a stream. Do you think that that just overall milieu, just that overall environment has been lost and that the overall environment that we're living in now is hyper clean?
Yes.
And that we're missing microbes from the dirt. I mean, there are probiotics that are soil-based organisms, right?
Absolutely.
And the water, I mean, spring water must have a microbial diversity in it as well.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I do suggest caution in that right. regard, that, you know, there are some people who take that a little bit too far and think we should be going to, you know, eat scoops of soil. And I think you have to be careful because our modern guts are not accustomed to that pathogen parasite burden. So if you're starting with a depleted gut and you're introducing a bunch of, you know, foreign organisms in large quantities, it's probably not going to be a good outcome. But definitely, I think the normal small exposure to those things, you know, as you're moving through nature is definitely missing in the modern world.
Go gradually. I may or may not have eaten dirt before. I may or may not. I cannot comment on that. I cannot comment. You know, when I was hunting, one of the guys on the hunting trip, they were all super smart and savvy, was telling me that he'd seen some study, maybe you've seen the exact study, I don't know the reference, that just being in a wilderness environment and maybe breathing the air could affect things. You know, that we could see the microbiome just through the air and stuff, just being around trees. Who knows?
Yeah, potentially. It might be those plant phytochemicals too.
No, not those. Well, I was thinking about that as you were talking about the Hadza eating different food, and I was thinking, oh, maybe that's a down mark on the carnivore diet. We're always eating the same food. Mm. But we're definitely, I'll tell you what, when I was on the hunt, I got a deer with my bow, and I'm sure that my microbial diversity changed, butchering that deer and eating it, having the blood of it on my hands and respectfully appreciating that. But that was an interesting experience and really made me miss that. Okay, so because I've always thought, and Tommy and I joke about this, we're going to have a retreat center in like Montana or Oregon that's in the wilderness. And, you know, some of these patients that just can't seem to get better, we're just going to be like, all right, just come to our retreat center, hang out in the woods, go for a walk in bare feet, get a little dirty, jump in the river. Let's just put you back. Like, we need an ancestral dunk tank. Like,
yeah.
How do we simulate that? No probiotic is going to simulate that.
No.
You know, we're sitting on manicured grass in Scottsdale that certainly has chemicals on it. I don't want to think about it. I would not eat this dirt. But I think that there's something to be said that perhaps we just can't reproduce a wilderness environment for our gut and for diversity in general. And that's got to affect us in some certain way.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. So we talked about that a little bit. What we didn't talk about was fiber. Mm-hmm. Let's just talk about this. And I think we agree on this most of the time because I heard your talk at Ancestral Health Symposium. A lot of people say we need plant fiber for a diverse microbiome. And just kind of like we've seen with the stories from Dennis Burkitt that I talked about in previous podcasts with fiber and diverticulosis or fiber and constipation, it's a reasonable hypothesis to say, hey, our low-fiber Western diet is decreasing our microbial diversity. But what's the evidence you've seen for that, or is there evidence to the contrary?
I think it's a little more complex. So I guess, yes, fiber can be helpful in some cases, but is not necessarily the end-all be-all that a lot of people and a lot of bloggers about the microbiome tout for gut health. I think there's alternative ways that we can support our gut epithelial cells, and one of those is ketosis. It's actually a really powerful way to support the gut, especially in an inflamed situation. So I know you've talked about isobutyrate being another potential route. So essentially, fiber ferments to butyrate. And that's one way that we can support the cells that line our colon, is because they metabolize, at least in a healthy gut of someone who's eating primarily carbohydrates, you're getting about 70% of your energy in those gut cells is coming from butyrate, from the gut, from fiber. But if you eat a more protein-rich diet that doesn't have as much fiber, you're going to be getting protein fermentation into isobutyrate. And isobutyrate can fulfill a lot of the functions of butyrate in the gut in terms of signaling. And then you're also probably going to be getting a lot of ketone production. So if you have ketone production in the blood, or, you know, by the liver coming into circulation, then you also have the ability for gut cells to pick up ketones from circulation. And that feeds into right into the butyrate metabolism, the butyrate metabolic pathway. Butyrate is actually turned into beta-hydroxybutyrate before it's used for energy. So I think in that sense, fiber has potentially been misstated as the only way to support gut health. And I'm not anti-fiber. I'm also kind of not going to sit here and say fiber is absolutely essential for gut health. In general, I believe that the optimal diet promotes metabolic flexibility. And I think that for some people, a low fiber diet might be really beneficial, especially acutely therapeutically. Whether it's the optimal diet for long-term health, I don't know yet.
Yeah, we
don't
know.
I don't think anyone knows.
Neither do I. So what we're really talking about here, we're back in the colon,
mm-hmm.
and we're talking about these specialized colonic epithelial cells,
right?
Which really rely on short-chain fatty acids from the lumen of the gut, from the inside of the gut, for their metabolic fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, in most Westerners, that's coming from carbohydrates, resistant starches, carbohydrates that make it to the gut and are fermented there into butyrate.
Mm-hmm.
And what's been so interesting for me as I've gone through this is that I do hear what you're saying in the mainstream. And I know you're not saying this, but other people are. Like, if you don't eat fiber, you won't make butyrate. Your short-chain fatty, where are you going to get your short-chain fatty acids? And so it was very interesting for me to learn and to see sort of reiterated in your work that we can make other short-chain fatty acids from protein. People may not know this, and this is not putrefaction. This is not a bad thing. We can make short-chain fatty acids, isobutyrate, propionate, acetate, from protein. And as I heard you talk about it in Ancestral Health Symposium, there are some good papers showing that isobutyrate can trigger the same receptors as butyrate.
Mm-hmm.
As you hinted at in your discussion there, butyrate does more than just fuel the colonic epithelial cells. It touches receptors. It has a signaling role. And guess what? Isobutyrate can do the same thing, sometimes even more efficaciously. Right?
Yeah.
And what I love about what you said and what you blogged about on your website was that in states of dysbiosis or in states of inflammation, and I'll let you kind of piggyback on this and elaborate, if the gut is inflamed, getting ketones, getting beta-hydroxybutyrate from the blood side, now we're on the opposite side of the colonic epithelial cell, can go into the same metabolic pathway as butyrate and can be fuel for those colon cells. Because, and I'll let you take it from here, it sounds like in states of dysbiosis, cells might not be able to get butyrate into the colonic epithelial cells from the lumen, right?
Right, right. So if there's inflammation in the gut mucosa, those colonic epithelial cells are inflamed, then you essentially have impaired uptake of butyrate. So if that mucosa is inflamed, it's not going to be expressing the transporters to bring butyrate from the lumen into the epithelial cell. So in that case, it might be beneficial to get ketones from from the blood instead, at least until the gut barrier can repair. And then perhaps you can go back to a more metabolically flexible state where, you know, you can consume fiber if you like, or, I really think that people have been stuck on this idea that we need high fiber for the microbiome. But if you consider that we co-evolved with our microbes in states of periodic ketosis, periodic fasting, periodic lack of carbohydrate sources, the idea that our microbiomes would be, you know, dysbiotic during fasting, during ketosis, just is illogical. And, and you also think about populations like the Inuit who eat a very animal-based diet. And are we going to say that they don't have a healthy microbiome? Or, you know, do they just have a microbiome that's really well adapted to the diet that they eat? And so I think it really comes back down to we as humans are unique in that we have this metabolic flexibility. And it's in great part due to the metabolic flexibility of our microbes as well.
You know, The Princess Bride, where he goes, inconceivable. It's inconceivable that our microbiome would not be able to handle periods of low carbohydrate and low fiber. Mm-hmm. And there's a great study that looked at this, right? And you're probably familiar with the study where they had a plant-based group and a carnivore group. And they weren't like a nose-to-tail carnivore group, so they weren't like super carnivore. But they did a nose that they did a carnivore group, and it was only a week. But they looked at, number one, they looked at the alpha diversity, and it didn't change, meaning that people had a standard diet, which was omnivore, and one group went plant-based and one group went carnivore. And the group that completely eliminated fiber didn't decrease their alpha diversity. And they actually increased their beta diversity, I believe. And so what they were saying was, well, this is interesting. The alpha diversity didn't decrease when we removed fiber. And they say in the paper, this probably has to do with the ease of shifting of the microbiome, periods of lack of fiber, periods of animal-based foods coming back and forth and moving. And so we have a very malleable microbiome. And this has been one of the things that's been kind of important for me to talk about and learn about and share some message about with people and say, hey, like the messaging out there in the space that we absolutely need fiber to have a healthy microbiome is not true, in my opinion. It's not supported by the evidence. As people may have heard me say, I'm not against carbohydrates. I'm actually not against fiber, per se. Like, you know, when I did a podcast with Stan Efferding and I said I wasn't against carbohydrates, half of my audience, you know, fell out of their chair. I'm joking. You guys are great. You didn't fall out of your chair. But I'm not against fiber. And I think, you know, I've had good discussions with Tommy in which we have talked about possible utility for low-fat, high-carbohydrate diets in settings of dysbiosis. You know, if the gut is inflamed and you can't get butyrate across, ketones might be beneficial, but there are other possibilities in which if there's a proteobacter overgrowth or a gram-negative overgrowth and you put a whole bunch of fat in there, are you just moving a whole bunch of LPS across the wall with lipid rafts? You know, there, Tommy certainly says that he's seen clinically some situations where people do better on a high-carb, low-fat diet. And so I think that's totally viable for some people, and we're trying to figure it out.
Right.
One of the things that's important for me, and I talked about in my talk today, is there's a spectrum of plant toxicity probably, and if you're going to choose carbs, choose good carbohydrates. Mm-hmm. You know, I would think of those as squash, but you know, what are some of your favorite sources of fiber? I never thought I would ask anyone that question on the podcast.
A lot of people have asked me that, and the funny thing is that I don't really think about my fiber that much on a daily basis. So I really just I eat meat, mostly meat and vegetables, and typically vegetables that are lower on that toxicity scale. And the autoimmune protocol was really helpful for me in clearing my eczema.
Like an autoimmune paleo?
Paleo autoimmune protocol.
So tell people a little about that. Like, what kind of stuff did you exclude? What did you focus on?
Yeah, so that excludes the typical paleo, grain, legumes, dairy, refined sugar, processed foods, refined seed oils, but also eliminates nuts, seeds, eggs, nightshade vegetables.
Like tomato, eggplant.
Like tomato, eggplant.
Goji berries.
Yep. I think I covered everything there. So that was really, really helpful for me. And I actually combined that with ketosis to heal my eczema, which was really beneficial and eye-opening for me. And I was also lower starch at the time, keto. So that was really, like, for me, if this was the only thing after trying loads of things that was going to help, that helped my gut, how could a high-fat diet really be detrimental to the gut microbiome? And that's when I kind of dug into all that research and came to some of the conclusions that I have in that blog post. But going back to plant toxicity, I think you make a great point, as you talked about today, that animal foods are the most nutrient-dense foods we have, particularly organ meats. I think people are really lacking in that department. So regardless of what diet you eat, if you can include animal foods with organ meats, I think that's going to be really beneficial in moving the needle. And then beyond that, I think you make a great point in terms of limiting plant toxicity and being aware, at least, of the potential anti-nutrients that are present in food. And I think that that's kind of a spectrum, and you can go from like the most damaging lectins, eliminating those, to down, all the way down to, you know, an AIP diet that is really eliminating a lot of those anti-nutrients, and then, you know, of course, all the way to full carnivore where you're not eating any plants whatsoever. So I guess I kind of fall more into that spectrum that I'd like to have more diversity in my diet and still be cognizant of those plant toxins potentially, But I like my blueberries and my dark chocolate a little too much to go go full carnivore. And I also think that, you know, the metabolic flexibility aspect kind of comes into my perspective on that as well.
No, I think that's totally valid. I would go so far as to say maybe you're carnivore-ish and you didn't even know, right?
Maybe, I suppose. I feel like if you looked at my plate most of the time, it'd probably be more than half vegetables, but I do eat quite a bit of protein.
Yeah, and as you suggested, most of your nutrients are probably coming from animals.
Yes.
Yeah. What organ meats do you eat?
I really like getting ground beef that's been mixed with liver, spleen, heart, and kidney.
Perfect.
Kind of all mixed together, and if I put enough lemon, garlic, onion... herbs on that, then I honestly really enjoy it. And that's I've also had some very good liver pate, and I really like pickled beef heart as well.
Oh, that sounds good.
Really good.
And there's a lot of companies doing this now. I know Belcampo is going to come out with an organ grind. White Oak has an organ grind. Force of Nature Meats has an organ grind. Some of those are my sponsors, not all of them, full disclosure, but I love those guys and I want you guys to support them. And that's a good way to get your meat. That's a great idea, just to grind it all up together. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. So where do we go next? Let's see. So I think I want to elaborate a little bit on the spectrum of plant toxicity, because I don't know if people have heard me talk about this. So okay. I'll give you my perspective. And I think it's very similar to yours. So I did a podcast with Anthony Gustin recently and talked about this, which should be out on his podcast soon. But, you know, we were talking after my talk, and I think of the least toxic plant foods as the non-sweet fruits. What do I mean by that? The non-super hybridized, like very sweet fruits. So this would exclude bananas, exclude things like apples and oranges, and include things like berries and squash and cucumber, which are we think of as vegetables, quote unquote, but they're actually fruit, right? They have seeds, they're fruit, they're moving things around. Olives. So that in my book, I have this spectrum of plant toxicity, and those are on the least toxic side. So I think that even if you didn't want to do ketosis, if you want to do carbs, in my opinion, something like squash might be a pretty darn safe carb. Exclude the skin, exclude the seeds. Things like the berries are probably less fruit, sugar rich. And some tubers might fall into that occasionally, but then we get a whole another series of vegetables. But I think of the non-sweet fruits and berries as the least toxic plant foods. And if you're including those in your diet, those are probably, in my opinion, and I bet you share this opinion, less likely to be toxic and less likely to be offensive to people.
Yeah, definitely. I do think there is, I would want to leave an open mind to the fact that I think that some people can do better with a higher carbohydrate diet that does include grains and legumes. I think it's possible that there are some people who can thrive on that, and it might be related to how our microbes have co-evolved over this period of agriculture that we've kind of developed an ability to detoxify and deal with some of these anti-nutrients. So I think it's really something that everyone should be aware of and kind of test for themselves, basically, you know, what effect those might have on them. And it's possible that some people would respond, respond better to grains than, say, nightshades, for example. And it's really individual in terms of your particular immune responses to anti-nutrients.
And then there's old Oxalobacter formigenes.
Yeah.
This organism that may degrade oxalates in some people, but is not present in a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's pretty hard to get back. Tell me a little bit about Akkermansia. We kind of touched on that guy. It's like this special organism. You see it on a GI map.
Yeah.
I mean, how do we make sense of this? Because sometimes, I mean, I see Akkermansia in carnivores. You know, sometimes I see Roseburia in carnivores pretty frequently. And so these are organisms people say you must have fiber to have Akkermansia, which is clearly not true. But then apparently if Akkermansia gets overgrown, it can be pathogenic.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on Akkermansia?
Yeah, so Akkermansia is a mucus-associated bacteria. So it lives on the gut mucus layer and generally at low levels is associated with lean body mass and health. So and metabolic health. And it's actually gained some interest as a probiotic for metabolic syndrome lately. But it does seem to have this kind of paradoxic effect. So I've seen a number of clients where essentially in states of...
We've got a visitor.
We've got a dog visitor.
I'm getting... This is my microbiome right here, right? My microbiome is increasing. Back to Akkermansia.
Yeah, so in states of gut inflammation, it can expand significantly to be more like 20 to 25% of the ecosystem. And these are people, when you see this, typically comes with massive small intestinal bloating gut symptoms. Whereas in healthy individuals, it's usually 1 to 3% of the population, or sorry, 1 to 3% of the total bacteria if it's present. In which case it's associated with health. In the group that's got 20 to 25% abundance of Akkermansia, I'm not sure quite what's going on there. There's no reports in the literature of anything like that that I have found. But it seems to be people who've got some kind of non-inflammatory bowel disease inflammation going on.
So not Crohn's or
not
ulcerative
Crohn's,
colitis.
Not ulcerative colitis.
But they have inflammation.
Some kind of other inflammation. And actually what's really interesting is that Akkermansia has been shown to expand in mouse models when they induce epithelial wounds. Akkermansia expands and helps to heal the wounds. So maybe this wild increase in Akkermansia is somewhat a healing response, but it definitely comes at the expense of diversity of the rest of the microbiome. So I'm not quite sure what's going on there with that elevated Akkermansia, but it does seem to be, if you see that on a gut test, it's probably a sign of idiopathic inflammation of some sort.
Unknown inflammation. And I see it on GI map. GI map is, again, quantitative PCR. I can see populations increased above their normal reference levels. On a longevity, you could get the percentages mm-hmm. overall. But yeah, I've noticed that. There's something going on here. People say it's generally good, mm-hmm. but we just don't know. We just don't know. So many of these species are so individual. And I'd like to get your take on this because people get really hung up on individual species.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard you talk about this on another podcast, and it was quite eye-opening for me that the Hadza apparently don't even really have high populations of bifidobacteria.
No.
And this is a species that everyone says, you need it. It's really good, right? And so everyone gets kind of focused on having enough Roseburia or having enough bifido or having enough mm-hmm. lactobacillus. But can we really say, and what's your take on this, can we really say that we know exactly which species you must have to have a healthy microbiome?
Definitely not. Right. Yeah. So again, a healthy microbiome is the microbiome right. you have when you're healthy, and yours is going to be very different from the person next to you. So we actually only share about a third of our microbiome with the next person, and about two thirds is individual to us. So it's really dependent on so many different factors, and we can start to say that we understand some characteristics that define a healthy microbiome, such as low abundance of those facultative anaerobes, higher diversity, but to pull out one or two bacteria, I think is very reductionist and isn't really recognizing that the gut microbiome is this complex ecosystem. There's cross-feeding going on between the microbes. You know, when we're looking at the fecal microbiome, we're not even, you know, we don't even know what's going on in the small intestine or close to the mucus layer. So there's just so much going on there that I think we need to keep ourselves from getting too excited about one or two specific microbes.
Yeah. And then in that study that we talked about that had included the carnivore diet for a week, the authors got all bent out of shape about Biophilia wadsworthia and other bile acid tolerant organisms. And I was talking to Tommy about this, and we were thinking, you know, like, of course you're going to get more bile acid tolerant organisms when you have more bile, and
right.
you're going to have more bile when you eat more protein. And though increased populations of Biophilia wadsworthia or some of these other things might be associated with inflammatory disease, it doesn't mean they cause the inflammatory
right.
disease, right? Like
right.
you said, it's a huge ecosystem. And so that kind of irks me when people point to those and say, you're going to increase bile acid tolerant organisms. And I say, yes, and do we know? You know, like, that's
right.
a good hypothesis, but we can't be sure. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, well, I mean, there are studies that have looked at Bilophila wadsworthia and
Bilophila. I said it differently. I love this. Like,
I feel like everyone pronounces microbial names differently. So
this is great. I was doing it wrong.
So some, to my knowledge, some studies looking in animal models have connected it to causally to cancer, but typically it has to be in this context of genetics and environment that really are leading that to happen. So it's not necessarily looking at whether that in the context of, you know, a really anti-inflammatory state of ketosis, is that really going to lead to cancer development, you know, in humans. I don't think we have any evidence to say one way or the other. But again, it's like, you know, the Inuit did not have rampant cancer, even though they probably had plenty of biotolerant organisms.
That's exactly what I was going to say. The Inuit. Exactly. So let's talk about a SIBO a little bit. This is a hot topic. So small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. We were talking a lot about the colon earlier and the colonic epithelium and butyrate and the short chain fatty acids. Let's move up into the small intestine. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk recently that SIBO might not really be what's going on, that they've done studies and they've looked for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, which is a condition in which people would say there are higher populations of bacteria in the small bowel with a jejunal aspirate on endoscopy. But that doesn't seem to hold up, does it? Doesn't it look like it's more a loss of diversity with SIBO, quote unquote? What's going on? What's your sense of what's going on with small intestinal dysbiosis versus small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, quote?
Right. I think unfortunately the bacterial overgrowth paradigm has led us down the wrong path for a long time. And fortunately there was a pretty large scale study recently that came out that suggested that it was small intestinal dysbiosis that was much more associated with the typical symptoms we think of as associated with SIBO, you know, bloating, abdominal pain, gas. So really we're talking about small intestinal dysbiosis, somewhat a potential lack of diversity there, but also just a general shift in the type of bacteria that are there. A couple studies have found increased proteobacteria now in the small intestine associated with those symptoms.
Dang, proteobacteria.
So, it's possible that some of the same mechanisms are going on in the small intestine there as well.
So we can maybe revisit this now. What the heck is causing SIBO? What do you think? And I can offer my ideas too. I don't think anybody knows. We certainly don't have great treatment. We can talk about your ideas for that too. But what is causing small intestinal dysbiosis? SID.
Yeah.
I renamed
it. I think a lot of the things that hold true for colonic dysbiosis are true for small intestinal dysbiosis as well. So antibiotics are certainly going to have a major role there. I think the amount and density of processed foods in the Western diet, even in some ancestrally minded but more processed diets, you know, like processed tapioca flour, almond flour, those concentrated carbohydrates are potentially delivering a very high carbohydrate bolus to the small intestine and disrupting the balance there. So that's one possibility. You know, there's a lot of things that can potentially play a role there. You know, lack of exercise to help with gut motility. A lot of things that can affect gut motility can particularly affect the small intestine. So a lot of the things that have been associated with SIBO, right? You know, SIBO doesn't necessarily isn't necessarily the right term we're looking for now. We know that it's small intestinal dysbiosis, but a lot of the things that we would have said are connected to SIBO are, you know, likewise connected to small intestinal dysbiosis. So things that affect gut motility, often it starts with some kind of gut infection that affects gut motility, and it develops as a post-infectious etiology.
And I see this over and over in my practice. People go to Mexico, which is great. It's beautiful. Good surfing in Baja. And they get enteritis. You know, they get GI symptoms. They get traveler's diarrhea. And then they have GI symptoms after that. And it's really tough to rehabilitate. And so I love that you brought up motility. SIBO definitely seems to be associated with motility, whether it's the migrating motor complex, this myenteric plexus. I've heard other people talk about this too. Maybe it's an autoimmune disease, right? You get some sort of infection in the gut, you mount an immune response against the gut nervous system, the enteric nervous system, molecular mimicry, who knows? Could it be plant toxins? Possibly. Could it be lectins? Who knows? Maybe. But something is going on and maybe it's slowing the gut. Something is changing these populations in the gut. There was an article that I found that I want to dig more into this, and I talked about this in my talk today, and I talk about it in my book, with lectins, specifically PHA, so phytohemagglutinin from red kidney beans, and at least in mouse models, you know, admittedly animal models, they showed that when they introduced phytohemagglutinin, the diversity of the gut went down, right? Because E. coli expanded. One of these proteobacter expanded. And I thought, wow, that's kind of almost like a model SIBO system by introducing a gut lectin. And they seemed to think that the mechanism had to do with the lectins negatively affecting the cells that produce mucus. The goblet cells. The lectins weren't necessarily associating with E. coli. They were associating with our gut and changing the way that it was producing mucus and creating holes in the mucus layer of the gut. And then E. coli was somehow able to contact the gut, inflammation and overgrowth. Mm. I thought, oh, isn't that interesting? So who knows? Lots of things there.
Yeah, pretty much anything that causes inflammation in the gut will lead to an overgrowth of proteobacteria. And that's probably where most of those overgrowths are starting, is something that causes inflammation in the gut, whether that be some kind of virulent pathogen, whether that be antibiotics depleting the substrates that our gut needs to stay in a healthy state. So that's actually what I'm covering in my talk tomorrow, is kind of some of those mechanisms to how can we intervene on those mechanisms to prevent that overgrowth of proteobacteria, or right, reverse it once it's occurred.
Yeah, we should talk about that in a moment. I just want to talk about one study that's come up repeatedly, or at least one urban legend, urban myth. So people, in addition to saying that we need fiber for short-chain fatty acids, people will say we need fiber for a healthy gut mucus layer. And there's this study from Cell. Have you seen that one from like 2016 in mice, where they introduced a human-like microbiome with 12 species that were carbohydrate-loving, and then they depleted the mice of fiber and they saw the mucus layer shrink a little bit? Have you seen that study?
I don't know exactly which one you're talking about, but...
Yeah. Well, the take-home point for me was that when they actually looked at the histology of that study, they didn't see inflammation in the gut. The mucus layer decreased a little bit because they introduced a fake human microbiome into these mice. And the microbiome was a microbiome that loved fiber. And as we've talked about, the microbiome can shift, right? They weren't allowing the mice to shift the microbiome. They introduced only 12 species into these notobiotic mice.
Right.
That's spelled G-N-O-T-O. And it means that they raised the mice without any microbiome. And that's the study that got quoted by Rhonda Patrick or others. Rhonda Patrick was on Joe Rogan saying, you need fiber or you won't have enough mucus. Have you seen anything that I'm missing that would suggest that if we don't have enough fiber in our diet, plant fiber, we won't have a healthy gut mucus layer?
I don't think so. And in fact, Akkermansia, that microbe that feeds on the mucus layer, tends to increase with ketosis and fasting. So typically, if you're consuming a fiber-free diet, but it's got lots of sugar and inflammatory things, then yes, you're definitely going to deplete the gut mucus layer. If you're supporting your gut epithelium with ketones, potentially isobutyrate, I don't see any reason that you would deplete the gut mucus layer. And in fact, the increase in the abundance of Akkermansia would suggest that it might even do the opposite.
Right, because how could you increase the abundance of Akkermansia if it didn't have the mucus to feed on during ketosis?
Right.
Right? Rhonda Patrick, I hope you're listening. Somebody send this to Rhonda Patrick. Listen, like, I respect Rhonda Patrick, and we shouldn't be promoting things that aren't true. And so it's an interesting, respectful conversation, right? Okay. Rhonda Patrick is listening to this conversation right now. One other thing I wanted to highlight that came up earlier that I missed was that there's an interesting study in cheetahs. Have you seen this one? I talked about it in my talk today, where they gave cheetahs collagen and they saw that the cheetahs could make the collagen into short chain fatty acids. And so I think of this, and I talk about this in my book, as this is animal fiber. So
yeah, although unless you're going to give yourself a cheetah FMT, I'm not sure that you're going to have the microbes to be able to do that. I don't know.
It's possible.
I mean, I would that you have cheetah microbes that can,
I would do a cheetah FMT.
That can ferment collagen. But
if you give me some cheetah poop, I'll do it.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that's interesting, but I think, and I think it's interesting to compare both the diets and microbiomes of other animals in comparison to humans. And we definitely have a gut that looks much more like an omnivore than a gorilla or a chimpanzee, but we don't have quite the gut that looks like a pure carnivore. So we're definitely somewhere in between, which kind of goes back to that metabolic flexibility that we can kind of, with as the seasons change, as food availability changes, we have the flexibility to eat, you know, within that spectrum.
But maybe if I'm eating a carnivore diet, my microbiome is shifting to look like a cheetah's. I mean, you could say that, like, my diet is kind of like a cheetah's diet. I don't eat the hair, but I eat the bones, you know? Like,
yeah.
I wonder. I thought that was pretty interesting.
I mean, honestly, my only concern with the carnivore diet is that you might lose your metabolic flexibility, such that if you ever wanted to go back to eating plants, it might be really difficult.
Are you talking now from a microbiome level or from a metabolic level? Are we talking, like, glycolysis level? Or are you talking,
mostly,
like, microbiome?
No, mostly microbiome level. To be fair, all these studies are in mice, but there have been some studies to suggest that if you deplete fiber in the diet for a time. Once you add it back, the mice are fine, at least within a short period of time, right? And it the microbiome can adapt. But how long that period is before, you know, those microbes potentially are lost is unknown. You know, in the Hadza, there's definitely that yearly cycling. So right. We think that, you know, 6 months without fiber, you'd probably be just fine. You could adapt when you, you know, return to eating plants. But, you know, how long you can go on a carnivore diet and then go back to eating plants, I don't think anyone really knows. Maybe you've got some anecdotes to look at that.
But, I don't think we know. I think we need to know. I think we need more data.
Yeah.
Maybe it means eat squash every 6 months, you know, like be metabolic, you know, but maybe it means eat berries every month or two, but the rest of the time you don't have to. Yeah. I think it's a great question. I want to do more with my gut. I've also not had great luck or felt like GI map was super reproducible, but I was looking at longevity and I wanted to start doing that. So one of the things we do know anecdotally about carnivores in the community is that they tend to have pretty high gut microbial diversity as we're measuring. I mean, 85th, 90th percentile. So like microbial diversity doesn't seem to be a problem. And carnivores don't seem to be developing Crohn's or ulcerative colitis or inflammatory bowel disease. So it's a question, but you make a great point. Like, could we be losing a carbohydrate organism? Who knows?
Right.
Do we need it? I don't know. Maybe it come back, maybe not. I mean, if you want to stay carnivore your whole life, maybe not.
Maybe not. But, you know, I think if you're also thinking about this, not in terms of just yourself, but generationally, there was a study published that looked at essentially, so that the mice that were returned to a high fiber diet, they could rebound, right? But if you fed mice a low fiber diet for 4 generations, their progeny could no longer had lost the bacteria to be able to metabolize carbohydrates. So if you think about how humans have evolved as metabolically flexible species, you know, if the world were to go carnivore, you know, would we collectively lose that metabolic flexibility, and what are the potential implications of that?
Yeah, I think the implications are the real where the rubber meets the road, right?
Because
maybe we just shed it. We don't need it, you know?
Maybe.
Who knows? I think it's an interesting question. So let's dig into probably the last part of this podcast, which will probably be the most functional for people. What have you found to be the most effective ways to fix this stuff in people? And this is going to be different on an individual basis, but what have you found to be some of the more helpful interventions? Like, how do we fix people's guts when they're broken? And I'll let you break this down however you want in terms of which conditions you want to talk about treating, but that's an interesting question.
Sure. And I think there's kind of a couple layers of or tiers of treatment. And the first, you know, at a basic level starts with diet, exercise, sleep, circadian rhythms, really getting kind of the ancestral principles in tune and see how much that can move the needle. And in terms of diet, I typically use some form of elimination diet. It looks a little bit different for every person. A lot of the people who come to me as clients are people who are restricted down to 3 or 4 foods. So I don't really do a lot in terms of telling them to restrict their diet because I don't think it's helpful. But then, you know, kind of moving beyond those, if those aren't enough to move the needle, then we're kind of looking at things that on that second tier, which is more like herbal antimicrobials, probiotics, prebiotics. And for some people that will kind of shift things. And typically we do testing before that to kind of direct that a little bit better.
Any probiotics you like? Is it dependent on what's in the gut?
It's definitely dependent on which is in the gut. But there's a lot out there that aren't evidence-based or clinically studied. And a lot of misinformation there. So some of the most clinically studied for safety efficacy would be Visbiome, which is VSL3. It's now rebranded as Visbiome. Mutaflor is actually a beneficial strain of E. coli that might basically outcompete those more negative facultative anaerobes in the gut.
Is that
so
Nicili?
That's a really interesting one.
E. coli Nicil?
Yeah.
How do you pronounce it?
Nissel? I'm not sure I've ever
Let's play the gut bacteria game.
I'm not sure if everyone heard anyone else pronounce that one.
Okay. Mutaflor. Can we get that in the States? It used to only be available in Europe.
I have had some clients have success getting it through online from Canada.
Okay. We got to go through like underground channels.
Yeah.
Huh? Okay.
A little bit for that one. What else? Saccharomyces boulardii.
Florastor. And then when I do Florastor, I only do Florastor because it's the strain, right? That's been studied as opposed to like generalized Saccharomyces boulardii.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. So strain is really, really important. Right. And a lot of people don't realize that. Yeah. So they see, you know, Lactobacillus rhamnosus on a product and think that, you know, it's something that they've seen in a blog article, but the strain is really, really important. It's like the difference, you know, a good analogy is it's like the difference between, you know, a poodle and a chihuahua can, you know, the strain of bacteria can be that different in terms of its effects on physiology. So
when we're talking about probiotics, it's very important. People will know if it's a specific strain because after the name, so it'll be genus and species and then a number with letters. And so I don't know the numbers and letters off the top of my head for Florastor, but it's Saccharomyces boulardii, right? And it's only that name brand. So in this case, name brand matters. Mm-hmm. And like you're saying, Mutaflor is a certain strain of E. coli, Nicillae or Nicille. And then VSL3 is now rebranded. It's a specific strain. Any others?
Consortium of strains
for that one. Consortium of strains, okay.
Those are the ones that come to mind.
Lactobacillus GG.
Yeah, sometimes I'll use that one, although I found that's not as well tolerated in people who have pretty inflamed guts. Mm-hmm. So I'm typically starting with the three I mentioned as kind of the most well tolerated potentially. I also have on my blog a whole analysis on soil-based probiotics because I know that that's of interest to a lot of people. So I kind of did a breakdown of which of those are most clinically evidenced, with Entero Germina being one that's been studied in Europe for 50 years, that's been shown really great clinical efficacy for a number of things, including like functional GI symptoms.
Can we get it here?
through back channels, yeah.
Lucy's,
you know, through an online pharmacy, you know, shipped from Europe. It's not like on the black market or anything.
Yeah. Lucy's probiotic, like under the table. No. Okay. All right. And then what about serum bovine immunoglobulins?
I have been really impressed with those lately, and I think there's a lot of evidence for them. I think a lot of treatments for especially like IBS and just colonic dysbiosis as well have really focused on trying to either kill microbial overgrowth or really try to, you know, fix the dysbiosis by fixing the microbial balance. And I think we need a little bit more focus on supporting the immune system and supporting the gut environment. And the beneficial bacteria will come once we have that. We were able to bring that inflammation down and support the gut barrier. Often that will lead to downstream effects in shifting the gut microbiome to a healthier state.
So these are immunoglobulins derived from cows
that
we take orally, and these little immunoglobulins go in and bind bacteria, and we sort of give an immune boost in the gut.
Right.
Okay, cool. What about other adjunctive therapeutics? Butyrate? Oral butyrate?
Oral butyrate could be beneficial. It's probably going to be a drop in the bucket if you're in ketosis already, in terms of how much it's going to do. And I also think that there's a lot of forms of butyrate on the market that are like sodium butyrate, calcium, magnesium butyrate, which are administering a large dose of butyrate and not targeted to the colon where it should be. So I'm a big fan of probutyrate, which is it's actually complex in a little bit of a fiber matrix, but it's intended to make its way to the colon and then be more of a slow release. So it's more of a physiologic dose.
Gets to the colon.
And it actually gets to the colon. So if someone was going to supplement with butyrate, that's typically my recommended form.
People have done butyrate enemas in the past for that reason, to get butyrate into the colon that way, because that's where we want to see it. But there's something you talk about in your blogs that sometimes on some of these GI tests, you'll see butyrate levels, and excess amounts of butyrate can be an indication that something is wrong.
I'm sorry.
Excess butyrate in the colon, excess butyrate, like excess butyrate producers.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, like sometimes on the GI tests, like could too much butyrate be a bad thing?
So I don't think too many butyrate producers, I've never seen any sign that that's a bad thing. Mm-hmm. Typically, if you have abundant butyrate producers, you're probably going to be in a very healthy state. Mm-hmm. So I think there's an issue with providing too much exogenous butyrate,
right,
for the reason that we might essentially put too much butyrate in a system that's not expecting that much. And essentially, when you have too much butyrate, especially in an inflamed state, it could potentially inhibit stem cell proliferation. Now, that's not going to happen at the physiologic doses from even someone who's eating a lot of fiber. Mm-hmm. But it would happen if you're taking like 5 grams of sodium butyrate to try and supplement and heal your gut.
So even could you get that much with probutyrate or a butyrate enema? Too much butyrate that could inhibit stem cell production?
Probutyrate is a much smaller dose. Mm-hmm. So you probably couldn't with probutyrate unless you're, you know, popping more than 10 pills. The butyrate enema, you definitely could overdo it with the butyrate concentration potentially.
So that could be a bad thing.
Yeah.
What else? Any other adjunctive therapies you think about?
Yeah. So that's kind of, those are kind of like that was kind of the second tier that we were talking about. Probiotics, SBIs. I'm really interested now in the people who don't get better with those two tiers and what we can do for the people who, you know, have basically tried everything in the book and aren't really getting better. So, part of my future research that I hope to do is looking at, how can we target those pathways in the gut that are leading to the oxygen leakage and the overgrowth of facultative anaerobes? And in some cases, I do think that there could be more potent interventions that could help that beyond just ancestral lifestyle, beyond probiotics. And one intervention in particular I've been really interested in is the acute use of mesalamine, which is actually the first line drug treatment for inflammatory bowel disease. And in IBD has actually been shown to have beneficial effects on the gut barrier, beneficial effects in terms of shifting the microbiome to what looks like a healthier state. So it does seem to be kind of treating the root cause in that sense. And I'm never a proponent of being on drugs long term, but I do think it could be a really interesting potential therapeutic to kind of shift the ecology of the gut back to a healthy state, and then you could maintain it with diet and lifestyle.
What about FMT? Fecal microbiota transplant for everyone.
definitely fits in there.
Cheetah poop.
I think a lot of people hold FMT as kind of the miracle cure, but in a lot of gut conditions, it's not as effective as we would hope that it would be. And especially in people who have kind of that chronic IBS, especially if they've got chronic bloating and constipation, for some reason that FMT doesn't really seem to take hold or really change what's going on. And I think it might partly be because we're trying to change the ecosystem without actually changing, you know, the underlying environment of the gut. So we're not supporting the gut barrier enough. We're just trying to put in a new microbiome.
So what about like FMT with butyrate and glutamine?
Yeah,
and
exactly. So I think that could be key.
Ketosis, you know, doing everything.
Yeah. So I'm really interested in kind of more integrative synergistic treatments and how we can kind of bring all of these tools that we have together to potentially shift the ecosystem back to a healthier state.
And right now it's hard for people to get FMT unless they have recurrent recalcitrant Clostridium mm-hmm. difficile in the United States. There's a clinic called Taymount, no affiliation, that will do enema FMT. And, you know, my question is, how effective is enema FMT? Most, for people that are not familiar, fecal microbiota transplant is the actual transplantation of a smoothie made out of human poop into your gut. And it's generally done via colonoscopy with a spray. They just go in your gut and they spray it. And now they've developed poop pills, and it's done all over the country now if people have recurrent C. diff, but you can't get it legally in the States if you don't have recurrent C. diff. Nowhere right. will do it. But there are people doing it now, FMT, and I know there are people in the community who have found improvements in their symptoms mm-hmm. by doing sort of do it yourself, not condoning this,
right.
but do it yourself at home FMT, which you can either do via enema or pills.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about pill FMT versus an enema FMT, for instance?
Yeah, it's likely going to depend on the condition. I think I'm right in saying for C. diff, they haven't really seen big differences based on the route of administration in terms of the efficacy.
When it's been studied with colonoscopy, probably, as opposed to enema.
Comparing the efficacy of oral FMT versus enema versus nasogastric tube.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So kind of looking at, you know, the efficacy and cure rates for C. diff. I think they've seen pretty comparable for the different routes of administration. But again, C. diff is a really, it responds really well to FMT. So maybe it's just not as sensitive. So I think we need more studies that are comparing kind of these different routes of administration and seeing if there's differences, especially for things like, if we think about small intestinal dysbiosis being really important for people with IBS symptoms, maybe if we're administering it more directly to the small intestine, then we'll have more efficacy than giving an enema, for example.
If some people had concerns about inducing SIBO with an FMT, and I thought, I don't know. What do you think about that? I wouldn't be as worried about it.
Yeah, I don't see that as likely because we basically have, again, bacterial overgrowth isn't that common. True bacterial overgrowth isn't that common. And we have defense mechanisms in our small intestine to prevent bacterial overgrowth. So I think if you're not providing a massive dose right to the small intestine, you know, and it's and supporting the epithelium in other ways, then I don't necessarily think that there's it's likely that that's going to happen. But again, we don't have a lot of studies on FMT and you know, small intestinal bacterial numbers and things before and after. So I think a lot to learn in that regard.
You heard it here first, guys. I'm going to eat cheetah poop. So I was in Texas and I was hunting in West Texas, and the Coyahuiltecan Indians were there, and apparently they used to eat deer poop.
Interesting.
You know, I think during times of starvation, they were just survivalists. But I'm thinking, oh, that's interesting. Deer poop. That's one way to affect your GI microbiome. I am not condoning this.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of other animals are coprophagic.
Right.
A lot of other mammals. You know, I'm not condoning it either. But
Dogs do it all the time. It's really interesting.
Dogs
do it all the time. They're eating poop. Stop eating deer poop. Stop eating duck poop. You know, it's like Tootsie Rolls for dogs. Who knows? And I mean, so I heard also that in Chinese medicine, there's something called yellow soup. Have you heard of this?
A bile. Isn't it?
What's poop? I think it's baby poop.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I thought it was for bile.
It's like, it's an FMT.
Okay.
It's made from poop, and I think it's made from baby poop. And so anyway, then you get the question, if you're going to do fecal microbiota transplant, where do you get the poop?
Mm-hmm.
I've definitely heard people say, like, maybe you just get it from a baby. I mean, mm-hmm. The baby's never had antibiotics, you know? Yeah. Who knows? How healthy is the mom? Who knows? This is the cutting edge stuff. You go, who knows? But I think that we run into this position a lot where people just can't, we don't fix them with the other things. And we think, gosh, what's next?
Mm-hmm.
Anything else you'd consider? Is that pretty much the full gamut? Aside from Tommy and Paul's retreat?
Yeah. I think that's pretty much the full spectrum of what we have right now. But I'm really interested in new therapeutics, and especially to help those people that have, you know, kind of seen every practitioner in the book, tried every diet in the book, and are still struggling with symptoms. I do think that I will say that the brain-gut connection is often overlooked, and also the impact of community and social life on gut health. I see a lot of people with irritable bowel syndrome that are really lacking in terms of the social community and their mental health suffers because of it. And I think that can really exacerbate and lead to chronic stress that impacts the gut. So definitely a multifactorial approach is going to be right and most helpful for people.
Yeah, and I should also mention that I've seen a lot of people do really well on a carnivore diet for gut stuff, and I've seen people not get fixed on a carnivore diet with gut stuff. You know, they'll try a carnivore diet and they're like, hey, it's better, but it's not fixed. So
right.
I also don't want to make it sound like a carnivore diet is a panacea for gut issues either, and sometimes they persist. I think for a lot of people, it helps with a lot of symptoms, and they resolve gas, bloating, constipation. Mm-hmm. There are certainly anecdotal reports of Crohn's and ulcerative colitis and all kinds of things. And there are some people out there that it doesn't seem to affect as well as we would hope, and we're still kind of trying to figure out what are we missing here. And I think we are missing something here.
Right.
I just think there's another piece of this puzzle that we're missing, you know, because I'll do probiotics and I'll do antibiotics, or I generally don't like herbal antibiotics or antimicrobials. That's just my personal opinion. I'll use pharmaceutical antibiotics before I'll use those. Maybe that's my bias. And then, you know, I'll do the SBI and I'll do these other things, and I'll try butyrate, and then I even got a couple of clients who were thinking about FMT or doing FMT, and we'll see where they end up. But I think there's got to be something we're missing. And that's why I'm like, is it in the dirt? You know, like, is it, are we supposed to be eating deer poop? Like, what is the answer here? Like, what are we missing and what's going on? And I love that you're a part of pushing this forward. So thank you for all of your super awesome work here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
So where can people find more of your stuff? And how do people work with you if they want to?
Yeah, my website is ngmedicine.com, stands for Next Gen Medicine. So people can find me there. They can also just Google my name. And it should come up. And I'm also on Facebook and Instagram at Next Gen Medicine. So they can follow me there. I'm currently not accepting new clients at the moment. But you can certainly subscribe to my blog at my website. And if I am able to open up to new clients, I'll be posting it there.
Okay. Now, the last question that I always ask people on this podcast, you ready for this? I should do people a favor and tell them this question is coming because people are caught off guard. But I like to see how they react. What is the most radical thing that you have done recently? This is like 80s radical. You ever see the movie Rad?
No.
It's a BMX movie. They do backflips and they do racing on a dirt track. Like think 80s music and big hair and like, it doesn't have to be 80s theme, but like this is radical. Like we're talking like really cool, not like, you know, revolutionary.
I scuba dived at the Great Barrier Reef. Recently.
That's pretty cool.
That was pretty awesome.
That's pretty cool. What'd you see?
Lots of clownfish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Nemos.
Nemos. Yeah. yeah. Parrotfish. Lots of, it was a really cool experience.
Just to be under the water. What was so cool about it for you?
I think just the diversity under there. You don't really, it's like this whole ecosystem that's completely removed from us until you go down there. So it was really cool.
That's pretty full circle. It's all about diverse, like just like it's diversity, right? Yeah. Like, and for people that have been in the wilderness, they will know that those are diverse ecosystems, right? And there are animals and plants and insects and yeah, the underwater is just this diverse ecosystem. Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, you guys, you know what to do. Stay radical. All right. Thanks to Lucy for coming on the show. Check her out, lucymailing.com. I think that she and I will have future conversations about the gut. But in summary, after the last 3 weeks, what we must think about now is that a healthy gut is defined by our experience of it, by how well we feel, how well we poop, how free from gas, pain, bloating, constipation we are. And we can use metrics like alpha diversity. Mine is incidentally very high on an entirely animal-based diet. Or we can use metrics like butyrate. But ketogenic diets, low plant fiber diets do not result in an absence of butyrate. There are plenty of short-chain fatty acids in there. And our guts can be completely healthy, just like the Hadza guts can be healthy with seasonal variations as well. We do not know what a healthy gut microbiome is, and there's probably not just one healthy microbiome. There are many healthy microbiomes, and there are many niches within our microbiome that can be occupied by many organisms. The Hadza don't have bifidobacteria. Why do we say that bifidobacteria must be present to have a healthy gut? If you have a gut or a stomach, quote-unquote, an abdomen that doesn't have pain or bloating, when you eat food, that is a really good sign. That is what you want. That is how you know your gut is healthy. And I think that is the key. And there is so much misunderstanding here. So many people are being told to eat more and more plant fiber when it just doesn't make them feel good. You heard that last week with Michael Ruscio. A lot of times fiber worsens the gut. And I had a friendly debate with Vincent Pedre about all of this, and we shared our opinions in the first episode 3 weeks ago. So if you have questions about the gut microbiome, and how to get it healthy, how to rehabilitate it. Listen to the last 3 episodes, you guys. They are great. And understand, you do not need plant fiber to have a healthy gut. As I've talked about in the past, you can use animal fiber. You can use collagen to be fermented into short-chain fatty acids. And ketones in the bloodstream can serve as fuel for colonic epithelial cells. Lots of cool stuff here. Send me an email, drpaul@heartandsoilsupplements.com, if you have questions. What we are doing at Heart and Soil is something that I believe in deeply, and that is nourishing you and your family with nose-to-tail nutrition. It is so critical, so important. These nutrients have been left out of our diets, and this is how we get them back in. However you can get them back in makes me happy. If I can provide a service and I can get them to you in desiccated organs, that is easy, more convenient. You want to take it to the top of a mountain or on a plane or to Asia, that is what it's about. Or you just need to get them into your kids or your family, or you just don't have access to the organs, or you don't want to eat them. Desiccation preserves so many of the nutrients. It is a critically valuable thing. So check us out, heartandsoilsupplements.com. As a listener of this podcast, you can use the code CarnivoreMD for 10% off your first order. I can't wait to hear from you. Send me an email. Please check out my other sponsors as well. I love what they are doing. Let's get checked. TryLGC.com/CarnivoreMD for 20% off your testosterone test or HSCRP or blood fatty acids. Maybe it's even RBC fatty acids. You can check how much linoleic acid is in your blood. You can do homocysteine. They have all kinds of good tests there that are valuable. TryLGC.com/CarnivoreMD. WhiteOakPastures.com. Use the code CarnivoreMD for 10% off your first order. BlueBlox, BlueBlox.com. CarnivoreMD for 15% off your first order. Nutrisense.io to get a CGM, which will change your life by being feedback in real time, or change your family members' lives. I can't wait for my dad to wear this. And forceofnaturemeats.com for pretty darn fantastic regeneratively raised meat. I love all these folks. I love you all. Go over to Heart and Soil, sign up for my newsletter, and send me an email if you have questions. Firestarter, Blood Builder, and Gut and Digestion are coming very soon. I recorded a podcast with Brad Marshall about the croissant diet, about polyunsaturated fats. That'll be out soon. I'm recording a podcast very soon with Ben Beekman to talk about different ideas around insulin resistance. I actually did get in touch with Peter from Hyperlipid. I'm going to get him on the podcast very soon to talk more about polyunsaturated fats. And I have an episode coming up on my blood work. I've done a ton in preparation for some very exciting podcasts in the future. Stay tuned for that. Wink, wink. And yeah, all kinds of cool stuff happening. Love you all. Talk to you soon. Stay radical.